Blog Talk Radio.
Live from the nation's capital, it's Quintessential Listening, Poetry, with host Dr. Michael Anthony Ingram.
Facilitate an entrepreneur, Ms. Cayenne. Ms. Cayenne, are you with me?
Yes, I am. Hi, Dr. Anthony Ingram. How are you
hello,
doing?
Hello. How are you, Cayenne?
Yes.
Okay, are we ready to start this journey?
We are. I am ready.
Okay. All right. So am I. All right. What is poetry, Ms. Cayenne?
It's an awesome question. Because one of the things I love, for me, poetry is more than rhyme and words on a paper. But for me, poetry is inclusive of that. But it's like the very breath that I breathe, the very essence of who I am. And what I mean by that is it's the expression of who I am. It's expression. One of the things I love to say when I speak about the things that I like to do, I try not to always limit it to poetry because I feel like my life can be a poem, if you will. So the creative expression of who I am is poetry. And whether that is telling a joke or embracing a homeless person, or if it's, you know, spitting on the microphone, to me, poetry is the very essence of my creative being and my creative self. Sounds really woo-woo, right? But that's kind of how I define it for me. Yeah.
Well, why do you think poetry is important? Why is it important?
For me, poetry is important because it speaks to not just creativity, but it speaks to one's voice. And I think it's important that we feel free to have voice, to have our voice heard, to have our form of expression, if you will. And oftentimes we may feel squelched or silenced. I think about women's National Women's Month, Women's History Month. Women have a history of being just that, squelched and quiet and silenced and, you know, put in the back. And so for me, it speaks volumes. Poetry is important because it gives voice to humanity and to mankind. And I think definitely as a woman, I find that extremely important.
All right. Well, please share one of your works.
Certainly. I'm going to share a piece that I sometimes use it as a description of why I love poetry and why I came into this poetry, or poetry, you know, found me. It's called Give Me a Pen. I don't feel so well. My heart is heavy and my soul don't know that it indeed will be all right. There's a dagger of disappointment dangling from my right shoulder blade, arms too fat to reach around and pull it out, pain too real to pretend it away. My eyes are bag holders, bags filled with last night's tears, and my cheeks are round rocks flowed upon by today's new tears. The ache of fear ballooned my ankles, swollen from standing too long, toes too afraid to wiggle in the sand. And my stomach, it flips and turns, it flips and turns. It flips and turns like a Ritalin-deprived breakdancer, and the room is spinning like records on a turntable manipulated by life. The DJ. Woo! No water or cold compress needed here. Just give me a pen with a permeable surface, and I'll write this pain away. I'll write the dagger right out of my back, and with my pen, I'll drain bags filled with wet hopes and soggy dreams. Instead of bags, my eyes will hold ink wells, and from my ducts will flow poetry. Poetry that liberates and sets the captives free, yes, even me. I'll elevate my legs on metaphors and monologues, redirecting settled blood from my ankles into my legs, from my legs into my thighs, from my thighs into my buttocks, into my torso, into my heart, through my spine, back down again, and into my arms, and into my fingers, my pen-gripping fingers. Give me a pen, and I'll write this pain away. End.
Incredible. Incredible.
Thank you.
What are some of the predominant themes of your work?
Predominant themes of my work include spiritual or faith, I should say that, faith and hope. And anguish. Poetry is often has been an outlet, a therapeutic outlet for me. And so sometimes my poetry has the rawness of my anguish or my discontent or my trial, tribulation. But more recently, and I've had to take note of it, I've had this theme around justice, some social justices that speak to, you know, issues of for people of color, and just some social woes. I found that that's also been a common theme in my work of more of late.
Right. How does a poem begin for you, with an idea, a form, or an image?
All of the above.
All of the above?
All of the above.
Tell me
yeah,
more.
I can
Tell
say.
Tell me more.
I, definitely, sure. Sometimes it could be an idea, so or an assignment. So I've go and perform and do things with all different types of audiences, and I had been asked a few times to come in and do a presentation with some fifth graders. And if you know anything, you know you're not. It's hard to be smarter than a fifth grader, and they're the
yes.
most challenging audiences, I think. And so I was asked to come in. Because not just to say, hey, we want to learn about poetry, but actually they were doing a unit on the American Revolution. And they wanted, the teacher wanted to demonstrate different ways to tell stories of history, the art, visual arts, and a visual historian, if you will. And so I was tasked, or there was a thought here, of how could you display, or not even display, but speak to this topic poetically. Which is a thought, you know, an assignment. And sometimes that is, you know, how I may write something. Other times it's a visual. And I think I'm a visual person, so a lot of times that may be the case. I've written a piece before that I witnessed things. I saw someone getting – I was witnessing domestic violence in the streets. I've written things about that. I've witnessed a man on the train crying and – wrote a poem about that. So sometimes it's visually what I'm seeing, whether it's a picture or an experience. And other times things are just happening and I want to say something about it. You know, I want to say something about it, you know? And so that's probably what I was mentioning earlier. Of late, I've noticed this theme around social woes or social justice. And I find myself picking up a pen and writing something I didn't think I intended to do, but it comes out, and it's probably whatever is happening. I feel like I have something to say about it. So probably all of the above.
All right. Now, do you sit and think through every word or every stanza, or do you write freely and allow the words to flow?
When I was younger and kind of starting out, I was more of a flower, I think. Again, poetry has been a therapeutic outlet for me. And so when I began to really write and journal, if you will, it was more of a flow because I needed a catharsis. As I decided to become a little bit more intentional about the poetry, it became a little bit more methodical. But, Michael, I can say to you, it really just depends on what's happening in that moment. I've sat in a park and had a bunch of sticky notes with literally one line on each sticky note and put a poem together like a puzzle. I've also sat on a train and just flowed right there in the moment. You know, it really just depends on the context. But I can say that as I've gotten older and more seasoned, I guess, it's a little bit more methodical, not a whole lot more, but a little bit more methodical in that I'm thinking through, you know, stanzas or pieces or sections of the poem, thinking through each section and then where I want to go and how I want to connect them.
All right.
Yeah.
Please share another piece of your work.
Sure. This is a piece, it's a little lengthy, but I've mentioned a few pieces, so I might as well share one of those pieces. So one of the pieces that I wrote just a while ago, I wrote this piece. I was sitting on the train. I'm not sure if you've heard this one before, but I was sitting on the train and literally witnessed a gentleman just sitting there. And he was weeping. I wrote something about it. It's called "I Saw a Black Man Cry Today." I saw a black man cry today. It was a peculiar sight to see. It nearly frightened me. Were my eyes deceiving me? Was this black man really crying right in front of me? I saw a black man cry today. Strangest place, sitting on the train in a public space. His tears fell down his face. It was so real to me. His pain I could taste. I saw a black man cry today with tats on his skin and cornrows in his hair, with a wife beater tank and the smell of smoke in the air. This black man cried, his soul he bared, even if it was just to me, the quiet onlooker who stared. I saw a black man cry today. I don't know exactly why he cried. Maybe it has something to do with a little boy by his side, or maybe somebody died, or maybe it was just a leak from the insides. I saw a black man cry today. I could only imagine what was going on in his head. Perhaps he realized that his potential had gone unfed. Perhaps he thought to himself, "My dreams are dead." Then he heard the voice of his son's eyes that said, "You're my hero, Daddy. Don't give up. Not just yet." I saw a black man cry today. I wondered what could cause this free expression of emotion. I wondered what could inspire this watery potion. Perhaps it was a bloody surrender to his frustration. Perhaps it was a response to his societal annihilation. Or maybe, just maybe, he was appreciating his emancipation. I saw a black man cried today. He smiled at his son and he smiled at his son and hung his head low. Maybe he wept for fathers like him who loved their sons so, for fathers like him who loved their sons so but didn't know how to say so. I saw a black man cry today. I could only creatively conjure a reason for this occasion. I could only speculate the specifics of this sad situation. I can only pray a prayer for my proud black male population. Thus, the following words and dedication. To my brothers of a darker pigmentation, I pray that you will rise up and defy the societal annihilation, that you will convert frustration into imagination, that your constructive imagination will drive your internal emancipation. To my brothers of colors, don't just wish to be taller, hoping to be a baller. Don't be driven by the mighty dollar, but rather reach down into your quiet place and holler. Call forth your Mandingo power. This is your time. This is your hour. To the brother I saw crying on the train today, and to the brothers who will live to cry yet another day, I acknowledge your tears. I empathize with your fears. I know that all isn't always what it appears, but this I do know. Your freedom is near. Your freedom is here. It's here in this poetic prize. It's here in the voice of your son's eyes. It's here. It's here. Right here. It's here in the palm of your hands. Here at the soles of the feet by which you stand. It's here. Right here. Your freedom is here. It's here in the sound of your quiet tears. Here, hiding in the strength of your fears. Right here. Your freedom is here. So I say to you, my brothers of colors, rise up and lead. Rise and follow the godly creed. And though your tears, they are real, real indeed, they can be transformed into powerful seed. You have everything needed to succeed. So even as you cry, black man, remember your hope to feed. Even as you cry, black man, remember you are free. End.
Powerful. Powerful.
Thank you.
Powerful. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
Back. My name is Michael Anthony Ingram. I'm here with Ms. Kyan. The calling number is 646-787-1631. If you'd like to ask Ms. Kyan a question. Ms. Kyan, I have a question.
Sure.
All right. When did you first start writing, and what made you feel the need to express yourself in this way?
Started writing, my first recollection was second grade. My mother's recollection was when I was three. She transcribed something that I must have stated and signed my name to it. And I remember finding it and was like, wow, this is something that I realized. So it said something like, a little flea had wings. The little flea had wings, but never learned to fly. I thought to myself, golly, dang, girl, you was deep even at three. But anyway, so that was when she, that was what she says. But I remember at second grade, it was probably the first time that I recall writing a poem. It was an assignment in school. And at the time, I lived in the Midwest. In the Midwest, in that school district, they published a citywide magazine from kindergarten to 12th grade, and poems, short stories, musical scores, and artwork that we were doing in school as assignments. Teachers would submit some of their students' work for this magazine. And my first published piece and first written poem that I could recollect was second grade. And my mother was a writer, a creative writer, and so she introduced me to words. I used to read the dictionary as a kid and make my own vocabulary words outside of a school assignment, because vocabulary list, I'm sorry. outside of a school assignment, because I loved being able to have a new word to pull out, you know, type of thing, and then try to use it in something. My mother was the one who introduced me to that concept. And so, but I really, it became a part of me in a way that just like my right arm, because it became an outlet for me to express and to grieve and to deal with the loss in my life. Before the age of 12, I had experienced a lot of loss. My mother, my brother, my father, these people either were passed or were abruptly removed from my life. And so very early in the game, I had grief and loss and needed an outlet. And I'm grateful that poetry was that outlet, because it could have really been something different. I definitely had the potential to become what many may call a statistic, being raised in a single family, you know, experiencing welfare, not having a lot of money, things like that, and having loss, easily could have been a statistic. But poetry really, and I know it's corny, but I say yeah. it and I mean it. It literally saved my life. So I began to really write as a way to live, because there was no therapist. There was none of that. It was just me and my journal. So, yeah.
I know that you share that poetry is my friend, my catharsis,
yes.
my gift to the world.
Yes, definitely. I live by that.
All right. Very nice. You know, all great writers have great writing influences. Who are some of yours, and what makes them great in your eyes?
You know, I enjoy individuals. I've enjoyed over the years poets such as, of course, your Maya Angelous and your Langston Hughes. I really enjoy his work. A little bit of Kelsey Cullen. I mean, I love the classics that Harlem Renaissance era, even Gwendolyn Brooks. Probably my first, these are memorable things in my mind. In high school, I think it was my junior year, we were introduced to the research paper, you know, with the thesis and citations. It was my first introduction to that. And so my paper was on Gwendolyn Brooks and, you know, the Black experience and how she spoke to that Black experience through her writing. And it involved analyzing and, you know, not critiquing, but just really delving deep into the poetry and the cause behind it. And I fell in love with not simply her style, but it wasn't just the poetry, it was the message, it was the cause that really kind of opened up my eyes to, oh, you can do this with a cause attached to it. So I really enjoyed Gwendolyn Brooks. But as a kid, it was Shel Silverstein. And to this day, he's probably one of my favorite authors, a children's author and poet. Simplistic poems, but very, very poignant. And I like him even more than Dr. Seuss. So they're you know, County and Maya and Langston and Shel Silverstein, you know, these professionals that we kind of all know, their household names. I do enjoy their work, and I don't know if I mimic anything there, but I do enjoy the power behind their work. But what I have found more so of late, when people have asked me that question, who do I look at and perhaps may you know, take a little bit of their style and maybe craft it in my own work, it's not your household names. It's the other local poets and authors that I come in contact with all the time in the poetry scene. I mean, you know, you've had her on your show. I think Dee Scribes is one of my favorites now.
Yes.
Her rhythm and her style. I can't really do what she does, but her rhythm and her intensity, I love. I enjoy Pages McCom, which is the director of poetry at Bus Boys and Poets. You know, he's directing stuff, but he's also a poet and the author, and his work and his process is is very intriguing to me. I enjoy that kind of thing. So a lot of my influences of late have been local, no names to the household, but names maybe in the area that I live in D.C. So, and they have become influential for me.
All right, very nice. Please share another poem.
Definitely. This is called Dear You. I mentioned before that you asked me the themes, and some of my theme thematically is often a speaks to faith, speaks to my faith, or speaks to, you know, that kind of topic. So this is called Dear You. Dear you, you have no idea how strong you are. Your spine is made of flexi steel, agile, shock absorbing, never broken. I have never spoken of this strength before, not because it doesn't exist, but because you have always closed the door on this belief, your reality laden with grief, blinded by the insanity that your humanity was vanity. Life seemed to serve you up on styrofoam plates and plastic cutlery, warm leftovers, fine china seemed imaginary, but what good is a fancy bowl if the contents is old? Little do you know how strong you are, how bold you are, how unlikely to fold you are, and while others drop and break like those china plates, you bend and lean, and if at first you don't succeed, you try, try, try again, stand up again, and hope again. Your strength is strong like God's light on a Sunday morning. Incredibly, you keep rising like God's light on a Sunday morning. You have no idea how strong you are. Your legs are made of titanium, bionic like an alien, corrosion resistant, fully competent to stand, even when you don't understand. Don't you get it? I am your biggest fan, not in an infatuated kind of way, but in everything I made was good kind of way. See, it pains me every time you question your tenacity, because with every question, the audacity of your doubt renails me to a cross of limitation. When will you walk out the liberation that I bled out for you in my crucifixion? When will you wear the victory that I gave you in my resurrection? When will you learn that I am a mathematician? See, your weakness plus my strength equals perfection. Stop saying you can't do the math, because I'm the teacher, the tutor, and the equation. All you need, you have, if you would just grasp. Stop bowing in obeisance to social media's meritocracy, or better yet, bend your knee at Calvary. Has anyone ever told you how strong you are? That your spirit is irrepressible and your wins are non-refundable? Has anyone ever told you? That your heart is made of unbreakable feathers, and though the weather is nearly unbearable measures, it keeps thumping and pumping and beating the charges held against it. I know that what I say is true, because, baby, I made you. I made you from the imported metal with the invisible kettle that the Big Dipper rested on. I made you with the periodic table's finest, creating elements just for you, defying gravity and laws of physics too. So when I say your strength is strong, please don't dismiss me and tell me I'm wrong. But better yet, stand up in this truth and say it with me. I am strong. I am strong. I am strong. End.
You share with such conviction. Where does that conviction come from? Which leads me to my next question, too.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you hail from? Poets hail from all over the world. Where do you hail from? So I guess it's two questions in one. The conviction, and where do you hail from?
My conviction. Let me see. That's a good question. Let me think about that. I think My conviction comes probably from this belief. When I decided that I would do poetry outside of my journal and outside of just, you know, my little diary and share it in a public space, I came to that place because at some point there was some kind of interaction where my journals, my diary became, it was something, whatever I wrote in my journal or my diary, I shared it with someone outside of that private space. And their response was, I needed that. That helped me. That blessed me. And at some point, the light bulb went off in my head, and I believe God really kind of brought me to that place to say, now you have to understand that what I've given you is, number one, it's a gift. Number two, you should not hold this gift to yourself and hoard it. So now, number three, you have a responsibility to share it. And so that was a convicting factor for me, because my poetry and my writings or my expressions was my safe haven. It was mine. You know, it's like, you know, you hold it close to your chest and it's for me. It was a place where I could say what I wanted to say and do what I wanted to say, and no one had to know. But when it shifted to help me to understand, hey, this isn't just for you. It's actually for the world. And I know that sounds big, but that's what I'm saying, is when you talk about purpose and that kind of thing. So it shifted for me, and it became more of a passion and a conviction and a call. So with that said, there's a message, right? There's a message that should be shared. Somebody may need to hear it for whatever reason. So with that said, I think the conviction that you may hear and that sometimes others may hear comes from the belief that this is a call and there's a message that has to be, proclaimed. And that's a responsibility. That's probably where the root of that conviction may come from. And then I'm a drama queen, you know, so you know, that's probably the other part of it.
All right. Nothing wrong with it.
Let's just call a thing a thing, where do I hail from? I am, and I don't say this in a negative way to put myself down, because I think a mutt in a lot of ways. I was born in Jamaica, Queens, New York. I will always claim New York, even if they tell me that I can't because I don't sound like a New Yorker. Mm-hmm. But I will always claim New York as my home. That's where I was born, and my mother's side of the family is from Brooklyn. And I will always claim New York. My mother was a black woman, and my father was a Ghanaian, West African man. So I always like to say, I've said when I was, even as a teenager, I'm a true African American. That would be my introduction sometimes. But I've lived in various places. I've lived in the Midwest. I've lived in Omaha, Nebraska. I've lived in the Eastern Shore, a little southerness. And I spent a little bit of time in California and Hollywood. And I've also, but now I currently live in the DMV area. I went to college at Morgan State University, and I stayed in Baltimore and stayed in the area, you know, since moved to D.C., but I've stayed in this area for several years at this point. And it's funny because I think I've kind of said now this is home, but I'm not sure. I think I got one more, maybe two more moves. I'm not sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, guess what?
Another piece?
No, not right now.
Oh, okay.
We have some callers.
Oh, wow. Great.
And hopefully they have questions for you, so hold on one moment.
Okay.
Area code 240, the first three numbers are 353. You're on the air. Questions for Kyan.
Good afternoon, good evening. I mean, I've been having so much fun with Miss Cayenne today. I don't even know what time of day it is. This is Lady Di.
Hi, Lady Di. How you doing?
Lady Di calling, and I have more of a statement than a question, because you're getting so much.
I'm sorry.
I just want to say, because I said earlier today that I was emotional behind your program, your session today.
Yes.
And I think when I think of how dedicated you are to the arts and to poetry and sharing so much consistently, you've been doing this for a while now, for years that I know of. You're very encouraging and very enlightening, and at this time and space and what we're going through, it's a blessing to have someone in your life and in my life like you. And I thank God.
Thank you. Oh, gosh, thank you so much.
Right.
I appreciate it.
Thank you, Lady Di. Thank you very much.
Yes. Thank you.
All right. All right. That was very nice.
Area code,
yes, 443. The first three numbers are 962. You're on the air with Miss Cayenne. Hello? Well, maybe they're listening. All right. We'll try another. Area code 301. The first three numbers are 356. You're on the air. Hello? Maybe they're listening. They're there. So many of these people. Hold on. All right. I'll keep going here. Area code 202. The first three numbers are 455. You're on the air.
Hello. How you doing? This is Tony. How you doing, Dr.
Hi.
Ingram and Ms. Cayenne?
Yes.
How you doing?
Hello.
I'm good, sir. How you feeling?
I'm good. I enjoyed the session today. Just want to thank you. You definitely brought me out of a dull and sunken place with my poetry. I got lax in it and didn't realize my gift. And I had a question. My question was already answered by Dr. Ingram about how old you were when you first wrote your first poem. But I have another question.
Yeah.
So how important is it for a poet to build on their vocabulary?
How important is it for a poet to build on their vocabulary? Well, you know, from my perspective, it's important. Now, you know, various authors and poets and have different styles and things like that. But here's my philosophy on, you know, writing and even vocabulary or information and exposure. My thought on that as a poet or as a writer, or as a creative, is it's important to continue to challenge yourself. And what I mean by that is I like to write the way I like to write, and that's how I express myself. Sometimes I make up words. Sometimes I do a lot of repetition. I love alliteration. You know, I have a style. I have a voice of my own. But at the same time, I realize that there's more out there. There's other things, there's other styles. Otherwise, that's what I was saying earlier, that a lot of local poets and their various styles are very strong influences for me because they challenge me not to copy them, but they challenge me to go outside of my comfort zone. There's a gentleman in Baltimore, Analysis, and whenever I hear his work, I mean, it's a straight-up history. It's probably a whole textbook in a poem, and I'm like, man, he made allusion. Right. He alluded to so many different things. He used vocabulary. I need to look that up. I don't even know. Do I know what that means? So it challenges me to come outside of what I know. And I say that as far as your question about vocabulary, not just words, but, you know, exposing yourself to various styles, to new words, to express yourself, to make a point, to appeal to various audiences, history, live, you know, that kind of thing. Just exposing and expanding your own repertoire can influence your poetry or influence your writing to be broader and bigger and even more impactful. So I think it is important, but not just from a sense of words, but just expanding in general your experiences.
Oh, wow. I appreciate that. That's good.
All right.
No problem.
All right.
Can I ask one more question?
Another question?
Yeah.
Yes.
Have you used your creative writing for other than poetry, anything like film, plays, books?
Yes. The film piece, I have done a poetry video, but I haven't had my work in a film yet. I've had a few offers, and potential collaborations. We just haven't sealed the deal. I've never been able to seal the deal. Sometimes it was on me, and sometimes it was not. But I know that it's coming, so I definitely intend to work towards that. But I have, you know, a couple of chat books. Matter of fact, one of them is Syncopated Hearts. I've read from that tonight already. And the newest one is The Right Blend, W-R-I-T-E, which I'm a part of a collective a poetry ensemble, and it's six of us. And so we're on Amazon as of today. We just got on Amazon as of today. So, and my work is in there as well. So, I've used it in plays. You know, I've been able to direct plays, and sometimes I've inserted my poetry there. And then other authors who are not poets per se, but they have books on different topics. They've asked me to contribute to their book with a poem. And there's a few books out there where, you know, my work may be a part of the book as an introduction or a tribute or something of that nature. So I have, but, you know, to go back to the film piece, it definitely is. Definitely is something I'm looking forward to in the future.
All right. Wow, okay, appreciate it. That's a lot. I'm try to get some of the information from you later on. No, thank you.
All right.
Thank you so much. Enjoy yourself.
Appreciate it.
All right. I think we have time for two more here. Area code 571. The first three numbers are 331. You're on the air with Miss Cayenne.
Hi. This is Describe.
Hi, D-Scribe.
I'm so excited to call and ask a question.
All right, please ask a question.
to kind of go on something that you said very early in the broadcast about the way that you write is different. For when you were growing up, that you used to flow more, I think, and that it has changed a little bit with age. So my question is, how has age influenced your content, or maybe not necessarily the flow, but how has it intensified your content or maybe restructured your writing?
Yeah, I believe that just naturally – life, living experiences, maturation, it will change. If I read some of the poems, I don't think I can get to it quickly right now, but if I could read a poem, you know, that I've written when I was a young adult, I think there was some deepness in it. But when I read it, I can tell that it's written from a frame of mind that is just younger and hasn't had experiences yet. You understand what I'm saying? So I think very naturally age does affect my work. It has affected my work by just living experiences and maturation. Also, I think the change of, as age is related to that, or, you know, time is related to that, is learning, for lack of better words, change. When I was younger and I was writing a lot, like I mentioned before, it was a lot of processing pain. I also grew up in the church, so I had a lot of poems about faith and God and things of that nature too. So again, but that's still a part of process of trying to work through this stuff. And you know, I have a poem. My first poem that I recall was talking about love. What is the meaning of love? Love is kindness. Love is happiness. And it was, you know, it was wonderful. You know, a cutesy. But I have another poem, What is the Meaning of Love, right? Probably a couple of grades later, or maybe a little bit later. And it was so dark. It was so dark, you know, because, again, what I was trying to process. Now, the change or the pivot or the shift is at some point you've been processing, working, navigating, and at some point we reach a pinhole of light. And so that becomes a shift in my writing as well. Often I noticed that what I would do is I would write pieces, and I like to paint a picture. I like to paint it poetically but raw at times, and then shift. And then there's a shift in the poem, and it goes from whatever this visual is, whatever this experience is, to but God, or but there's hope, or but we move from here. And you'll see a lot of that in some of my works as I got older. And I think that comes from being able to have gotten to a place, rather, where there was a shift, there was an opening, there was a pinhole of light and we're going to try to make this pinhole as big as possible. And you see that happening in my work, you know, more so as I got older.
All right.
Great. Great. That was a beautiful response. Oh, and I'm sorry, Dr. Ingram. Hi.
Hello. Hello. How are you, D-Scribes? Always good to hear your voice. All right. We've got time now for one more caller. One more.
Thank you.
And we're going to go one more time. Area code 571. The first three numbers are 299. You're on the air.
Hello. Hi. My name is Asha. And I'm also a poet in the area. Hello, Dr. Ingram. Hi, Ms. Diane.
Hello.
How are you? Hello.
Well.
Hi. So, yeah, my question is actually, so I've been writing for a while. I do poetry and open mic and different things, but I'm just getting into the space where I'm looking at poetry as like a business or a career. And personally, I find it challenging to sometimes it can be challenging to kind of keep the business and the personal part separate. So I know, Ms. Cayenne, you are very active in the poetry community. You run a full business, the Inkwell, which is a nonprofit. You write on your own. You do workshops. So you're inundated with writing. You host poetry. So how do you draw the line between when it's work and when it's play? Like, how do you maintain the pleasure in it, and are there things that you, maybe you keep to yourself? Do you have any tips for people who may be moving and navigating through the difference between, you know, writing for business and writing for pleasure?
Sure. So I can make sure that I'm clear and I want to answer the question properly, you're asking how do I balance between the writing for business and my writing for pleasure, and what are some tips to help others who may be needing that or wanting to move into poetry more business side of things? Is that the question? Okay. So I think that's an excellent question. I can't say that I've perfected that, but I do think this is a personal, I guess, drive for me as it relates to poetry, and which is my passion or and call, and the business side of things. Is that it needs to, there is a business, there's a, you know, the diplomacy and the order and the organization. That is something that has to be there. I can definitely have some tips around that. But I think for me, what is very important is I'm always asking the question when I'm invited or asked to do something, or I have an idea, which is almost every other day, I want to do this, I want to do that. You know, I'm always asking this question: does it align with what I believe I am supposed to be doing right now? Because if it's not, it'll become laborious. It'll become, you know, worky, and nothing will be, there will be no glory in that, right? It's just, you're just doing it because now I'm out of obligatory, you know, that type of thing. Now, hear me, you know, business, there are some obligatory things when you're running a business. You just got to do it. I'm not a great bookkeeper. I don't like it. And if you're going to have a business, you better keep some books. So there's some things that you're going to have to do that are obligatory. But as it pertains to the creativity component, I'm constantly asking that question. Whenever you see me doing an event or having an idea about this or about that, at some point, at many points, I've asked that question, and sometimes I've decided against things, or I've put, there's a definite end to it because I'm not going to do this for a long time because it's not meant to be long. So that for me is important. I think as business owners, as creatives who walk in, you know, begin to shift or are already walking in that business mindset, to really help you stay balanced is to do what you're supposed to be doing. And I'm going to use this term, do what you're called to do. Do what is your purpose, because a lot of things are good, but they're not expedient for you to be doing at that time. It doesn't necessarily need to be you doing it, you know. And so that can help make a great distinction. The things that help me with business, you know, and versus the pleasure is I always want poetry to be pleasurable for me and whatever that means for me. And so when I begin to move into things that are like not that, you know, I start to question again, ask that question. Here's a perfect example. I don't do poetry competitions, generally speaking. I'm actually in one now, but I generally don't do that. I have done them when I first started doing poetry publicly. You know, that's what you do. You do a poetry slam. You do a contest. That's what that meant for so long. And I didn't really enjoy it. It became super laborious. It filled me with so much nerves. I couldn't even freely speak the poetry because I'm in this competitive state. Some people are competitive. I think it's wonderful. For me, it took away the pleasure, and I never wanted to have that. And when I realized that's what it was doing for me, I made a decision that will not be my focal point. People have asked me, "Well, why don't you host a slam?" And I'm like, I'll maybe help out or something, but it's not something I'm drawn to do. Not because it isn't good, not because it isn't great, but because it's not something that I feel aligns with me specifically. It takes me out of the fun and the pleasure of my call. So that's how I look at those kind of things. And as long as it stays pleasurable and fun and purpose-filled for me, even when it's challenging, it makes sense, and I have the grace to do it. I don't know if that answers the question, but that's kind of how I see the balance between the two. Great. So, and I will add to that tips for people who are, you know, going into the world of business. And Dr. Ingram Asha has been very influential. She's another author and poet that I didn't mention, but she's definitely one of the people that I love how she did that in her style. Yeah, she definitely is, and he is, and Dr. Ingram, you are too. What I'm about to say is something that I actually have learned from you, Asha, is that it's important to have a team to help balance out this thing called the business of poetry, the business of creativity, because a creative really needs to be able to create. And a lot of these things that go along with having a business, it does kind of usurp the creative juices, if you will, because it can be very consuming, you know, keeping books, having meetings, making sure you do your taxes, you know, all the things that come along. You got to do it. But when you're a lone ranger, and now you're growing into your business, the creativity can suffer because now I'm doing all things obligatory, very little things of pleasure and passion. So I think it's important to have a team to help balance you out, volunteers, friends, until you can pay and, you know, build it as you go. But that's important.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
You're quite welcome. Thank you.
All right. We're going to take a brief break, and we'll be right back.
Great.
My name is Michael Anthony Ingram. We're here with Miss Kyanne. Miss Kyanne, I could listen to you all night long. You are a consummate professional. Whether you're sharing your poetry or talking about the craft, you're just a consummate professional.
Thank you so much, sir.
Consummate professional.
I appreciate that.
Oh. Please share two of your works, two or three, whatever you like. Whatever you like.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate this. I just wanted to say I really appreciate this opportunity to be on your show. I don't say it just to be saying it. I deem you as a super professional. And your work is just as awesome, if not more. But moreover, I honor you as an advocate for poetry and expression, and I honor you as a person who takes seriously the craft and the people who exhibit the crafts. You're very professional and respectful to the to the industry, and I just love to watch you flow as well. So I just want to say thank you. It's an honor to be on the show.
Thank you.
This is a piece called There Is Blood on the Cotton, and this piece is actually one of the pieces that is in the new book that will be that is already out now on Amazon, The Right Blend. I am a part, I guess I said before, is of a small ensemble of six poets, diverse. This group was brought together with the intention of bringing together a diverse group of poets. We are diverse in age and ethnicity, maybe religious backgrounds, as well as poetry styles. This book will show you the differences in our poetry styles, but there is a unifying factor called poetry. The piece is called There Is Blood on the Cotton. Snowy white and neatly folded, rows of tees stand at attention in the dresser, each one whispering, pick me, pick me, as eyes scan the open drawer. Textile perfection, almost, until the nick on his chin drips. There is blood on the cotton. And like that, the fabric of our lives is the fiber of his anguish. Rows of cloud-like purity stained with the blood of human chattel. King Cotton ruled with a leather whip. The economic backbone broke down many black bones, making bank bones, but only for the bones covered in white skin. Men, women, and children bow in reverence to a hot sun and a cold king, racing against daylight, ignoring the screams of their worn bodies, backs bent, hands picked, fingers pricked, blood drips. And there is blood on the cotton. Camera flash forward, snowy white tees still stand at attention. Perfection lost with one single drop, a sure castaway. With ancestral courage, his shaky mulatto hands reached in the open drawer and rescued himself. Under Ralph, Da Vinci, Armani, a subtle reminder, there is blood on the cotton. End. I am going to read another piece in my chapbook that is out of print, but this one is the chapbook called Syncopated Hearts. And this is a piece called That Table. This chapbook called Syncopated Hearts has about four chapters, different sections, I should say, different sections, and with a title for each section. And this piece comes from the section called Grieving Grandma, That Table. Boston Market catered my turkey day this year. Though grateful for the $22.41 needed to purchase this tasty meal, I was saddened that it was not prepared by her hands, served from her dishes, consumed at her table. In fact, that table is gone. Loaded on a truck with careless quickness, that table used to hold meals prepared in love. That table used to shelter the dogs from scolding tones. That table held mail sent to me years after I had moved away. That table now sits in a Goodwill with unfamiliar pieces of furniture, questioning what it did to deserve this relocation, this transition from a warm, purpose-filled home to a cold warehouse floor. That table hid my dangling feet during long prayers for traveling mercies before driving back to college. That table served as a church and office where sermons were prepared and community prayer meetings were held. That table endured the pressure of the pen, from letters written to local officials, congressmen, and other entities of power demanding that a wrong be made right. That table, covered with cloth and plastic, upheld hundreds of candles during countless birthday celebrations. That table hosted a family's last supper before its matriarched away from it for the last time. That table absorbed the fragrance of her spirit early that Sunday morning when it left her body, floating from her bedroom to the cumulus clouds of heaven. That table, though nameless, held everything in its wooden DNA. Resilience, tenacity, dedication, second chances, faith, and agape. That table held me up when my balance was challenged. That table never changed despite life's duplicity. So in whatever bleak warehouse corner that table now stands, the effulgent truth is that its life was well lived. That table. That table. And,
you know, writers and poets write for a myriad of reasons. Some write primarily to speak a message to their audience. Others write because to stay silent is not an option. Why do you write, Kyan?
I write so that I can, how can I say? I think I've shifted in the reasons why I write. Initially, I was writing to heal. I guess the reason still remains the same, but the healing was for me. Let me say it that way initially. The answer to your question is to heal. I write to heal. And initially, I was writing to heal myself. And now I believe writing is both to heal myself and prayerfully to heal others or help others begin to find healing or be free to heal themselves through their own creative expression. So I write to help, bridge the gap and to find healing.
All right, very nice. You know, so much is happening in the world today.
Yeah.
The coronavirus is unpredictable, it's strange,
yeah.
It's uncertain. And earlier in our conversation, when I seemed to lose my place and I started thinking about, again, my mother, the coronavirus, and I was like lost in thought there for a second. What do you see as being the role of a poet in modern day society? What is our function? What is our purpose?
Yeah, excellent question. I think our purpose is to inspire and to encourage. I think there's a two-sided purpose, though. So particularly in this time, I had another poet friend share just a few days ago with other poets, hey, this is a time where we need encouragement, we need inspiration, we need light, we need love. So let's do that, poets. Let's share some of that in our poetry. And it shifted me. You know, we can, depending on where you are, you know, we can speak about the woes of the world and kind of get caught up in that. But it was took me to a place of responsibility, which is your question. The responsibility of the poet is to, I believe, bring hope, healing, and light. But I think it is also the purpose of the poet to be the prophet and to speak and to bring to light, you know, what either is hidden or the injustices that are, they're not hidden, they're very much in our faces, but need to be spoken aloud and to make declared that we see them and we're not going to stand for them. So I think that the twofold purpose of the poet to declare and decree, to you know, cry out against injustice. And I think if you look at history, music, writings, particularly I think poetry and creative writings, and even film. You know, the arts often flow right along with history because it tells the story, and generations thereafter will listen to the music, will read the poems, and watch the films of generations before them. And that's the job I think of the creative, and I think the poet falls into that category, to tell the story, to cry out, to make it known, to prophesy, but also to bring inspiration, to bring light and love and encouragement.
Wow. You know, and that really was my next question. You know, they say that to see the world with complete honesty, one should look to comedians, artists, and poets. What do you think emerges naturally from your work? What emerges from you? and you've probably answered this already, but just what emerges from you when you share your work?
Well, that's a good question too. I think by listening to other people's responses, when I'm listening without judgment of my own self, I hear things like inspiration, and I know that's kind of generic, but what I hear is inspiration, but unto an action, and that's my heart's desire. So this is what I mean by that. You're aware I've done and I do a yearly event called The Gathering, Open Mic with the Cause.
Yes.
The idea is just to bring people together using the arts as a draw and to raise awareness around a particular cause. That's the basic idea. But there are so many subtenants to that event that I'm intentional about. One of them is having people to have a safe space where they can come and enjoy themselves, but also a safe space to share their creative gifts, whether they're, you know, vendors as entrepreneurs or poets or artists, singers, whatever. They can come and it's a safe space to do it. There's not going to be this, you know, ooh, they're popular, they're not popular. It's just a safe space. That's one. But the other piece is this, that when they come in that safe space, that they will not leave the same way they've entered, not just because they donated to a cause or, you know, they had a good meal maybe or some good snacks, but because they are changed in some fashion or form. And the reason and the way I'm able to know that that is what's happening is I've had people, you know, give their testimonials, if you will. I'm saying to you, Dr. Ingram, that people have come who have never written a poem in their lives, sit at the table at that event, and they literally are overwhelmed with the spirit of creativity, and they write something and they share it. Not only have they never written anything, but then they share it before people who are poets, you know.
Wow.
I had people come to the event and say, tell me later, hey, listen, Cayenne, it was a great event. I had a good time. I was inspired to start that business that I've been kind of sitting on. It wasn't even about what we were there for, but they were inspired unto change. So I think what comes out of me, at least that's what my heart's desire, is that when you hear me or you're a part of something that I'm trying to facilitate, that you are inspired and change, but unto change, unto something bigger than and greater than where you were. You know, if that makes sense. And that's
yes.
What I'm hoping is coming out of me. And if nothing else, it definitely is my desire that comes out of me, that kind of, you know, impact.
Share another piece of your work, please. I'm not going to keep you all night, but share another piece of your work.
Okay, what shall I share? Let me see. Let me get a... wait a minute. Okay. I had my little... my order, and I think I'm going to go out of... So this is... Let me say this. I host, I think you heard some of the question, the people on the phone with their questions. They were alluding to something that we didn't talk about, which is Words on Wednesdays. I do a weekly live on Wednesdays. Every other week it's a sharing, and the off week it's a, you know, you get the word of the week. And it's basically a writing challenge where either it's a word, a phrase, sometimes it's a prompt that we're all given. I'm tasked to make sure I respond, but anybody can respond, and either it's a word or something like that, and then you write, and then we can share it. So some of that was today, because I had that before we had the show, and this is a piece called He Waited for Her, and it really came out of Words on Wednesdays. This particular prompt, it wasn't a word, it was a phrase. He waited for her. That was the phrase. Everyone's piece had to start with that. So I wanted to share that. This is ode to the Words on Wednesdays, where, again, we're creating a writing community. He waited for her outside of the corner store. Every day she'd skip down the hill with the oblivious cuteness of an 8-year-old. He'd drop his bike to hold the door for her. She brushed by him, quickly saying thank you, but never locking eyes, not even for the 1 second needed to let him know he was alive. He waited for her in the west wing after her third period class, flying out of the gym unbearably beautiful. She'd always without fail drop a book as she hit the left turn down the hall to biology class. on a cue. He'd post up right at the bend. Hey, let me get that for you. She'd say thank you to his hand and rush off in a frantic frizzy, never staying long enough to feel the linger of his fingers on hers. He waited for her at the corner of Hillen and Cold Spring at 5 o'clock p.m. Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays, the sun competing for her shine. She sauntered to the intersection, phone in hand and Bluetooth in ear. Like clockwork, she nearly missed her time to walk because her conversation was all-consuming and her attention barely existing. He'd gently blow his horn, awakening her awareness as she stepped in front of his car, waving a thank you while running straight ahead, never seeing the smile in his eyes for her. He waited for her. Even when their lives turned parallel, he waited for her outside the corner store, hoping she'd get a hankering for some penny candy like she did when she was 8. He waited for her at the class reunion, wishing she'd drop her book one last time. He waited for her at every stoplight intersection, anticipating her delayed reaction to the walk sign. He waited for her until the day came. He saw her approaching his counter. I want to empty the contents of my bank account, she said, rummaging through her purse, looking for identification that he didn't require. She passed her withdrawal slip inside, refusing the simple eye contact he always desired. She waited, head down, dialing on her phone, perhaps calling someone who wasn't even home. Upon his return with cash requested, he thought today she'd finally see him and her eyes would discern his. He waited for her to reach inside the glass layer and give him a warm pulsed thank you. But her thank you hit the cold glass and fell on his fingertips as she took her cash. She didn't pause long enough to notice. Yes, he waited for her to see him, to look upon him, to acknowledge him, to let him know he was indeed alive, to let him know the sun shines even in the dark, to give him reason to breathe in after each exhale. He waited for her. He waited for her to see him so he could see himself in the reflection of her eyes. And if she could just bring herself to see him, she would see what love looks like.
You know, so many poems, so little time.
I know.
We've reached the end of our time together, but I need to ask you one last question.
Sure.
When people hear your work, they usually want more. I know I want more. What's next for you as a poet? What's next for you?
Oh, goodness gracious. Well, what's next for me? Part of what's next for me is working with the Right Blend, the group I was mentioning earlier. You know, we're building our, you know, cohesiveness as a group. We're building and learning each other even more, and so we've been getting invitations, and I've taken on an interesting role with the group to try to help us learn how to perform together. You have readers. I'm a performer. You have others who are readers, so helping us meld in that way. And so I'm interested to see how that turns out. That's one. And that's a collaboration, obviously, and I love being a part of collaborations. I am taking somewhat of a shift. I'm hosting at Bus Boys and Poets, and you know, right now COVID-19 kind of shifted us a little bit. We're still doing our thing, but I think one of the things I'm hoping to do, thing a little bit in that, like I think Asha mentioned, I have a nonprofit called the Inkwell, and the Inkwell is really at the heartbeat is using reflective writing, creative expression to help people heal, love themselves, and find their voice. And I'm looking to do programming and development with that. And part of that includes, obviously, poetry and helping people to find their voice in that way, sharing their stories, sharing their freedoms, if you will, as I have done over time. So I'm on a journey trying to figure out, trying to capsulize my process that I described today in today's conversation of using this reflective writing as a healing tool, getting to a point of the pin light of pin, the pinhole of light, and then now blossoming, helping others kind of have that similar experience. You may not be a poet like me, but how do I move from the dark place to the light? And I know poetry is a part of that. What it looks like specifically, I don't have an answer, but I find myself thinking that I'm doing some shifting and helping people heal through poetry in that way.
You know, I'd like to invite the right blend on my show.
Well, you know what? I think we can have that happen. I'll make sure I'll forward your information.
Yeah, I'm serious. I'm serious about it. Actually, I thought about it some time ago. But I'd like to do that.
Okay.
But I want to thank you.
Sure.
I want to thank you. I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart for spending time with us tonight. Again, as you know, we have an international audience, and I'm sure I'll be hearing from people, and I'll share those messages with you to let you know how
appreciate
they feel
it.
About your work. So thank you.
Thank
and good
you.
Night
I
to everyone.
I really enjoyed my time. Good night.
Right.
Thank you again.
All right. Good night, everybody. All right. Thanks so much.
Good night.